Roll 2d6, episode 22. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hello, loyal listeners. It's time once again for the annual KublaCon podcast. Roll 2d6, your regular guide into the jungles of gaming.
You know, once a year is counted as regular, isn't
it? I think
it?
That's annual. Yeah, that's right. All I know is that once a year is all my contract specified. Anything more than that is, up to us. So,
right.
But as you know, if you've been reading the frequently updated Roll 2d6 blog, we recently went to KublaCon 2009 and had a great time there.
If by recently you mean closer in time to the last KublaCon than the next KublaCon, then yes, that is completely correct.
That is exactly what I mean. So we've got a couple more months where that description is still valid. Mm. Like I said, we went there near the end of May, and we played a lot of great stuff.
Very little crap.
Very little crap this year. Even better, two of our old high school gamer friends came in from out of town just to go to the convention and hang out with us. And so we all had a lot of fun seeing each other again and playing a lot of games. Our friend Joey, who you may remember from an earlier episode, he was here from Austin, Texas. And our good buddy Mark was in from Las Vegas. And also my brother and frequent gaming partner Aaron was there for part of the convention as well. So we all had a great time at our mini high school gamer reunion.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. If I could describe it as anything, I would describe it as a touching John Hughes montage of friendship.
What song would be playing in the background of that?
Oh,
montage?
I don't know. It very well could have been Stand By Me. I don't know. That's one of those things. Or it could have been one of those great 80s hits that we love so well. Yeah, very Breakfast Club sort of thing. We were all marching in unison.
I'll describe the part later where we went out behind the hotel and I showed them the dead body.
Yes, there you go. So yeah, I had an absolute blast with these guys and of course Adam, and we all had a really good time at the con and got to hang out not only together but play some great games. And we're here to talk about the great games.
That's right. Yes, enough about our gaming buddies. You don't know them, and while I'd like to think that you, our loyal listeners, are happy that Nate and I had a good time, you really want to hear us talk about games, so let's get to that.
Yes.
We played a lot of things, although I personally didn't play as many games this year because I played more really long duration games, but let's go through them in order.
And we'll make the descriptions really long in duration as well.
I want you guys to feel exactly what I felt as I played these games.
A 6-hour game.
So if you're at your computer, you can go to the Roll 2d6 Flickr account right now, and you can follow along with the pictures.
Ooh, it's like a slideshow.
That's right. It'll be an annotated. It's like a multimedia presentation.
Wow.
Right here. So, let's see. So, first of all, after we had arrived and made sure that everyone was checked in, we were waiting around on Friday for our first games to start. And while we were waiting, Nate pulled out his copy of Hero Card Orc Wars, so that we could finally play a 4-player game of this. Nate and I have played it 2-player before, but it's definitely better as a 4-player game.
And by better, do you mean easier to crush the Orc King? Yes. Yeah, this is where I got to inflict one of my recent favorite games on everybody and make sure that I had a 4-player game out of it. For those of you who have not heard me talk about it before or don't have access to the Board Game Geek, the game Orc Wars is a hero card system game, meaning everyone has a deck of cards and essentially 3 statistics, and each statistic acts sort of like a mana pool, and your deck of cards have attack powers, defense powers, other special powers, and you're limited by how many you could have on the table by your stats. All the hero card games are played this way. Anytime you need a conflict resolution, it's done this way.
It's kind of a CCG feel in that sense, is what I've heard it compared to a lot.
Right, exactly. And it isn't... But the things don't have to necessarily be fights, depending on what hero card game it is. It's just any contest between two different things in the game. They use this particular system.
Right.
And in Orc Wars specifically, it is a fight.
Yes.
Every one of them is a fight. One of the players is always the orcs. And the orcs can either have the orc king or just orcs. And he commands a large number of very weak orcs that when they are banded together and all touching each other, well, not in that way, but when they're in consecutive spaces, they can combine forces and become a relatively powerful unit. The other players, player number 2 through 4, play as an elf.
And as these individual elf heroes.
Right, as an individual elf hero, a paladin, a ranger, and a
sorceress.
Thank you. So, and these guys are individually very powerful, much more powerful than any individual orc. But the game is set up with these movable map tiles where you put the maps out and you have scenarios, and the different scenarios will pit, like, you know, three of these elf heroes against 15 or 20 orcs, or, you know, 18 orcs or something.
I love mowing through the low-level orcs as I rush through the caverns there.
Right, you're rushing through the caverns or across the green, and you're ducking in and out of bramble, just slaying orcs as you go, and the orcs are doing their best to hold you back. Now, it would be unfair for me to say that this is a really super well-balanced game so that the orcs and the elves could win at any given time. Granted, I have not played enough to know if that's the case, so it would be unfair if I made an assessment.
Yeah, we really only played it a few times.
Yeah, but based on the few times we've played it, I honestly think that it's stacked against the orc in some very fundamental ways. But that's not to say it's not fun.
Oh, sure.
You just know going into it that the orcs are going to come on like waves on a seashore. They're going to crash in. They're going to do their best. And ultimately, they're going to be beat back into submission and slaughtered by the horrendous elves that go through.
Well, I know you like any game that has orcs in it. So
I do.
I'm glad we got to play this one.
Yeah, it was. It was really great. And I liked it. I liked it much better as a four-person game. I got to command a lot more orcs.
It scales the number of orcs with the number of players.
Yes.
And there's some reinforcement rules. So they don't all come on at the same time. You can only bring on a certain number of them every turn, things
right,
like that.
Right. And I actually thought it was easier to win as the orc in the two-player game, but that's neither here nor there, just based on the way that some of the maps were.
Right.
And the mechanics of getting across the board, having the elf get across the board. When you had elves coming from all sorts of different directions, it made it harder to concentrate orcs. Anyway, so that's your tip for the day. If you're playing it, concentrate your orcs.
Concentrate the orcs. That's always a good tip.
It is.
So Hero Card Orc Wars. I think everyone liked that one. And it's fun. And I certainly like also the pieces for this. I think they have some neat things. It's all these little pieces that you pop out of the little plastic cards, right, and assemble them. And we replaced a lot of the bases with differently colored binder clips.
Right.
Because the assembled bases didn't work that well, I think.
Although they were beautiful, they were very difficult to get things in and out of, and they were fragile.
And part of this game is you're having to put the stand-up orcs into the bases over and over again. Because different bases mean different things.
Yes.
And so you're having to disassemble and reassemble them a lot. So
just by using the colored binder clips, we made that a whole lot easier and a whole lot more durable.
That's right. And you can see a picture of that on the Flickr stream.
Right. And the final thing that I did, and I didn't do it for this game, but I did it later on in the con, is I went and bought a really cool orc figure to be the orc king.
Right.
Because in the game, he's a stand-up punch-out from a plastic card, and all of the elves are three-dimensional plastic elves. And
I
thought,
they're cool little sculpted plastic miniatures, and the orc king is just a little stand-up cardboard guy.
So I went looking through the bin of D&D miniatures to try to find a really cool orc, and I did. I found one, and he's now in the box. So anytime we play, I'll have an excellent mini for the Orc King.
Well, that's really cool. I'm glad you did that. That will make it better. Yeah, the Orc King himself is almost the equal of any of the elves, I think.
Right,
isn't that right?
Almost.
Only has one hit point, and the elves have multiple hit points.
Yeah, the elves have multiple hit points. He only has one, but he has the same amount of mana, right? Amount of ability. He just is more fragile.
So that was a fun game. I enjoyed playing that with four players.
Yes.
So then, next after that, we had our first actual scheduled game of the convention, and this was the Games Workshop classic game, Man o' War.
Man o' War.
You may remember us from playing this last year.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a game of naval combat set in the Warhammer universe, so those same familiar Warhammer races are all battling it out, but this time on various kinds of ships. And every race has its own types of ships that work in different ways with different types of attacks and movement and abilities. And the guy who ran it last year, same guy who ran it this year, he's a nice guy. I liked the game that he ran. He has a full set of all the miniatures for all the races. They're all nicely painted. And it looks really nice on the board.
It's a lot of fun to play because the miniatures are all really well done, and they're There's just so many of them. He's got every race, and he's got a full set, and you just look at that and go, wow, that's like a million man hours for the painting right there.
Well, I love playing these miniatures games at the convention because you can take advantage of someone else's man hours of painting.
Yes.
But yeah, so it's I still think this is a fun game, but the game, as we played, it takes a long time. Of course, we're doing a 7-player game, so maybe that's why. But this time, I was the Chaos Horn Fleet. And I had several ships with ramming attacks, actually, mostly ramming attacks, mm-hmm. and then one big flagship with some good ranged attacks. And then I also had the flying ship, which you may remember from last year that Nate talked about, because he had it last year. I had the flying ship, which is basically, it's a really pretty cool ship, but it is basically becomes a big target because everyone says, hey, look at that flying ship, let's shoot at it.
Right.
And then it dies very quick. Yes. Because it's not just another ship on the map, it's this cool flying thing, and so everyone kills it.
Right.
And it is actually some kind of a big chaos creature. It's called the Flying Cinch. Yeah. But anyway, it looks pretty cool. So we had a big map with 7 players, and I was pretty much matched up against Mark. He was on the other side of the map, and he had the Imperial Fleet, which is pretty much standard Age of Sail era ships with square sails and cannons.
Yep.
Done no magical or fantasy thing. It's pretty much standard Age of Sail ships. Mark and I were coming at each other in the middle of the map. We both rammed into each other, and both ended up nearly destroying, completely killing all of each other's crew just due to lots of back and forth boarding actions. Boarding is particularly deadly in this game. Nate, you had the Chaos Dwarf Fleet this time.
Yes,
I
did.
And you were facing Joey, who had the regular Dwarf Fleet. What did you think of those ships, and how did they compare to what you had last year? You had the Chaos Horn last year.
I did. Well, I just want to preface this by saying that I'm getting a little tired of hot dwarf-on-dwarf action.
How can you tire of that?
I know. You know, that's big part of the win conditions in the game, and it was the way that the game was set up with the, you know, the victory conditions. It makes it really worth a lot for the dwarf player, the chaos dwarf player, to fight each other, and some of the other ones less so. I had no incentive to go fight anybody else because I got more points for fighting the dwarves, and so it was almost kind of weird because you have this giant battle and it ends up being three smaller battles of two or three each.
Yeah, he had it kind of set up that way because each player, each race had it. He had a sheet he handed out which told you what your victory conditions were, and you had some points for killing some people and some for killing more for killing other people, and ended up matching people up like that.
Yeah, so in the game that we played last year, it was also dwarf on dwarf, and I guess the Chaos Corn Fleet was they fought somebody else, whoever happened to be nearby.
That's right.
But because they're fine picking on anybody for the most part, but the dwarves have to fight each other. I liked playing the dwarves. I thought it was a different sort of play. I liked the fact that we had some high-risk weapons. They were weapons that could possibly kill you or your own guys or other ships of your own, and you had no accuracy.
Some guns that could do a lot of damage but might also blow up your own ship. Right,
exactly. But when you hit, you hit hard, and you hit for good, and they're down. And so that's pretty much what happened, is I got in a couple of really good rams and a couple of really good distance attacks, managed to kind of beat Joey down a little bit with his regular dwarves. He was only saved by the fact that he had a couple of underwater submersibles that can't be targeted normally until they're up out of the water. And it was fun. I enjoyed it. It was a different sort of play than the Chaos Corn Fleet.
The dwarf ships are a little different because they are not sail-bound or oars. And so you're a little slower, but you can go in any direction you want.
Right.
Because you're steam-powered.
They're steam-powered, paddle-powered.
Both of the dwarf ships, the Chaos Dwarf and the regular dwarf, are like that. So maybe that's perhaps a good matchup for them.
Yeah, so we could pretty much go anywhere. And they started us at the far end of the wind, so it didn't matter that we were on the far end of the wind because it didn't matter which way the wind was going. And for some of the other ones, it would have been really bad for them to start off on the far end away from the wind, downwind of everybody, because then they could never go back upwind.
Very slowly upwind to meet everyone else.
Yeah. So I like that. I disapprove of the way you ran the Flying Siege, but that was your own decision.
That's right.
It died quickly without doing a whole lot. And
that was my bad.
That's all right. Well, you were hoping. I mean, you got fooled. You got fooled by the I can put all of its movement into damage and do a damage thing, but then it just sits there. And when it sits there, then it's a target. And that was the problem.
You have a certain number of dice with that ship, and you can put them either into movement or attacking. or self-repair, I think.
Right.
And so I would, like, I could go really fast, because I'm not attacking anyone, fly right up into the battle, then put all my dice into attacking,
right,
and do a big shot, and now I have no movement left to escape, and then they just shoot me.
Then they just shoot at you and kill you, yes, which is, I think, exactly what happened.
So it is.
It was a lot of fun. My criticisms of the game in general are the same as they were last time. I think it's just a little too fiddly, a little too many single dice rolls. Roll this. Oh, now it's a 6. Now roll a 1d6 again. Oh, now it's a 2. Now roll 1d6 again, and then I roll it, and it's a 1.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, how come I can't roll 3 of 3 different colors and just figure out what it is, or have some sort of roll designed where I don't have to do layers and layers of rolls? But other than that, it was a lot of fun. I liked the big area. I like naval combat. I like fantasy. I like fantasy combat. I like minions of Khorne, and I like chaos dwarves and their bloodthirsty ways, and the Skaven's giant battle bell. And that's just made it all worthwhile.
That was pretty cool. So, so that was a good game in it. And that lasted
hours and hours.
I think
that
was like 6 or 7 hours. Anyway,
it was.
Something like that. So that was all of Friday night, pretty much.
Now, I just want to say for the record here, I got in second place in that little tournament thing, and I won a couple of Kubla bucks.
Oh, all right.
That I spent later on.
Cool. So, well, I think I came in far, far in the end. I think the Skaven guy won.
He did.
Because he got the battle, or the Bell of Doom, I forget what it was called,
right,
up to such a high level that it just killed everyone within
a certain radius
or something.
Yeah.
So that was Friday night. The next day, our first game of Saturday was the one that I was pretty excited about in this con, which was the Battle of the Alamo. So there's a set of rules out there, and I don't know where he got them, but I'm sure they're out there. I should find that. And there's some rules out there that someone has written for fighting out the Battle of the Alamo, and they're using a system based on Legends of the Old West, but with a bunch of simplification on it.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same. It's similar, based on...
Yeah, and they put a lot of simplification, because you really need that, because you're talking about hundreds of miniatures here. So Nate, Mark, and I, along with one other player who we met there, decided to control the Texian forces, and there are about 4 or 5 other players controlling the Mexicans.
Wait. Did you say Texian?
I did say Texian.
Is that really the way it was?
That is how they what they called themselves at the time.
Wow.
Not Texans, but Texian.
Score 1 for historical correctness. Score 2, or well. Anyway,
minus
sounded
1.
Weird. Minus 1 for sounding weird.
That is what they called themselves. So about 4 or 5 other players had the Mexicans. So as you can see, if you look at the pictures up on Flickr, the guy running it had a fantastic Alamo model.
Beautiful.
Very nice. And he had hundreds of miniatures for the Texians and for the Mexican army.
Giant flats of Mexicans.
I know. And as well as cannons, different sizes of cannons, and ladders for the Mexicans to scale the wall. And these are little ladders built out of what looked like logs tied together with rope and everything.
Yeah.
Very cool looking.
Oh, yeah.
And so this game was a lot of fun, despite it being about 6 hours long. Once again, just like the other one. So now let me be clear. As the defending Texian forces, we, of course, expected to lose. And, it's history. That's what happened. The rules are pretty much set up for that. But the question is, in this game, how long can you hold out? There are 3 waves of Mexican soldiers that come in. And you are, as the Texians, expected to pretty much hold off the first one with light losses, hold off the second one with heavy losses, and then make the third one pay dearly before losing your last guy.
I don't think we ever got to the pay dearly part.
Yes. So the Texians have cannons. You're mounted on the corners and the sides of the Alamo. And the Mexicans are charging directly into these cannons, as was their policy at the time. And the Texians have well-trained men, which are shooting from cover at soldiers who are charging in the open. So the rules account for this, and the Texians have a much better chance to hit while the Mexicans are charging. And they do that for every wave. There's a large period where they're charging from, 30 inches away up to the walls.
Right.
But then once they get over the walls and start to engage you in melee combat, it evens out quite a bit, and that's how we ended up losing most of our men. Now, the table is quite large, and so we were not even physically standing near each other. So we ended up each commanding the defenders on one section of it. Pretty much independently.
Right.
But we did all end up falling back to the fortified chapel by the end of the third wave. And at the end, there were, I think, only 10 or so Texians left out of how many? Like 100?
Yeah. About
like that.
Yeah.
And 80, 85,
I think there were
like
80,
that.
Yeah.
About 10 or so left, holed up in the chapel while the Mexicans were ramming the door down. And so I think we called the game at that point.
Yes,
it was a lot of fun. What did you think about this?
Well, I just have to say, I'll always remember it.
Well, as well you should.
It is the Alamo, after all. You know, I was surprised that we held out as long as we did, really.
Yes.
I want to fault two people for this. One is one of the players on our side, who I'm not going to point fingers, who just wasn't concentrating fire at all, and it was getting to be really disturbing that he wasn't concentrating fire.
Yeah.
And it could have been me. I'm not pointing fingers. I'm just saying that some concentration of fire should have happened by our side.
You do need to concentrate fire.
Yes, and the other thing that that really should have happened is I want to fault the Mexican players.
Sure.
Every single one of them.
Okay.
Because they all ran right into the cannons.
Well, you know, that was what they're supposed to do.
Well, no. Actually, here's the thing, is that in the Alamo, there is a barricade area that they don't have to climb with a ladder.
The palisade.
The palisade that they can walk over. Now, they do have to march along the walls to get to the palisade.
Right.
But then they don't have to stop and send men up one man at a time up the ladder, all the while being fired at from above and fired at from cannons. They can just walk over the palisade and engage in hand-to-hand. And as soon as that third wave happened, the Mexican players noticed, one of them noticed, hey, look, there's the palisade on that side. And as soon as they walked in that palisade, we had a ton of guys still left by the third wave. We had a ton of guys. And they wiped them all out in a giant wave of Mexicans coming up over the palisade and just killed dozens and dozens within one turn because they all engaged in melee as they came in over. And those that weren't engaged in melee were shooting.
Yeah.
And because they were coming through the gauntlet of the ladders and subject to the fire of the cannons, they were losing lots of guys. But on the third wave, they went to the palisade immediately, took their light losses running away from the cannons and towards the palisade, and then stormed the palisade and just wiped us out really fast on the third wave.
So they should have all come in on the first wave.
If they had done that on the first wave, they would have. We may not have gotten to the third wave. They may have just come in and wiped us up and then... Possibly we would have survived for the second wave, but unlikely.
Well, I think the way it worked, and I may be wrong about this, is that did we have to set up first and then they could choose where they came in? Or did they set up first and then we placed our defenders in each wave?
I don't remember.
I can't remember.
I don't remember. I think we set up first, actually. Because we left the palisades completely unguarded for all three waves. Because... No, I guess we didn't. So we were doing it in response. So they were setting up along the edges, and we were setting up guys that could hit them, and so we left the palisades open.
But see, if they all went over there, we just would have put all the cannons over on that side, maybe, and
that's
shot
true.
Them all down.
They would have tried. Who knows? But still, you know.
But still, yeah, it would have been a different strategy. And
It was very interesting in that the first two waves, the amount of belly aching that happened on the part of the Mexican players was astounding. It was every turn as we were mowing them down with cannons, they'd be like, I can't believe this. Who came up with the rules for this game? This game sucks, or whatever, just left and right. We shouldn't even be playing. We're going to lose. It's blah, blah, blah. And then by the third wave, they're like, how do you like it now, Texians? How do you like it now? Look at this. And went from belly aching to gloating. So fast. It's amazing.
You know, they needed to see that this was expected, that they would lose the first wave.
They were fated to win, and they didn't realize it.
You know, you just got to get through that wave. They should have just said, okay, we're going to lose the first wave. We'll take out a few of their guys.
Right.
We'll lose the second wave. We'll take out more of their guys.
Right.
And then third wave is where the actual fight happens.
Yes.
This is what you need to know when you're playing this game.
Right. And if they thought that, they would not have bellyached. I would hope they would not have bellyached so much for the first 4 hours of it.
Because it's like each group of Mexicans, I was fighting a couple of different, I don't know what the correct term is, but squads of Mexicans, let's call them.
Right.
And they were in groups of 30. And so I'm firing my big cannons at them, and my big cannon could take out in the first wave 3d6 worth of them with one shot.
Right.
And they could shoot back at my guys who are firing from cover, and they get to roll one single d6 for every squad.
Right.
At an attack on one guy.
And they only got a hit on a one or something like that.
They had a 50-50 chance of hitting one. But I had, you know, like 12 guys all there shooting down. Every one of those guys had a 50-50 chance of killing a guy also. So.
Right.
Yeah, so they were fated to lose the first two waves. They just needed to just get through that. And
yeah. So it was a lot of fun. I always remember the Alamo.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I got a lot of good pictures of that. And because we were there for so long, I ended up taking tons of pictures.
Yes.
So, that's probably the one I have the most pictures of.
Right.
So go ahead and take a look at that. And I even shot a little video with my camera there. Yes.
It's a multimedia extravaganza. There's a video, too.
I'm just flipping through all these trying to get to the next game. So, That was the Alamo. So let's see. So that was our pretty much morning to afternoon. I think we started that at, I don't know, like 8 or something.
Something like that. Yeah.
So after that, we went to have lunch, I think, and then we went to our evening game, which was B-17, Queen of the Skies. Now, if you look up this game on BoardGameGeek, you'll find that it's a solitaire game.
Published. Well, then how come like 30 of us played if it's a solitaire game?
Well, let me answer that question.
Okay.
It was a solitaire game published by Avalon Hill in the 80s, and in this solitaire game, you take a single B-17 out on a mission, and this, of course, for those not familiar with World War II bombers, this is a big bomber with about something like 12 crew members who'd all do various things, and pilot, co-pilot, various gunners, bombardier, radio man.
I have to do a little shout-out to our friend Mark here, who looked at the B-17 and knew which edition of the B-17, which building class of the B-17 it was. He's like, oh, it's a B-17G or whatever it was.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, how do you know? And one of the guys that was there working says, yeah, absolutely, because the G had the this and the that and the other. And Mark goes, yeah, but it's no match for the F, which had the underbelly double gun 17 blah blah blah. And I was like, man, Mark, just score on the B-17 history, dude.
Yeah, he knows his World War II. Yes,
he does
better than I do. So yeah, so in the solitaire game, you take a B-17 out on a mission, and it's all basically a whole bunch of charts you roll on. So you go through various zones of the flight as you get to the enemy, to the target zone. You get attacked by enemy fighters. You shoot back at them. You take damage from the fighters as you get hit. Try to repair yourself. You drop your bombs on the target and then go through all of it backwards, trying to get back to your landing zone and then trying to land safely. So it's lots and lots of charts and die rolling. But, you know, yes, there are people who really like it, and they like the story it tells in their head of that whole simulated bombing mission.
You know, I knew nothing about this game when we got into it.
Yeah.
And I looked at the sheets, and I looked at the chart, and I thought, this is an Avalon Hill game from the early 1980s. And sure enough, we looked up the year and we're like, oh, exactly it. Look at that, Avalon Hill, 1982.
That's right. Yeah, so you could tell exactly by all those charts.
By
so
the number of charts.
It is incredibly detailed, so I thought. And there are lots and lots of charts and lots of ways for your plane and crew to get damaged. And it tells the whole story, so that's neat.
Yeah.
But that is not the game that we played.
Why are we talking about it? No.
Well, it's for contrast.
We're playing a game somewhat, but not entirely unlike it.
Yeah, so he called it that. But the guy who was running it had made some modifications to this so that it was now a multiplayer, multiplane, and multi-squadron game.
Yeah.
So I had thought,
much better game.
When I read his description, I thought he was going to modify it so that each player played maybe one crewman on the plane. And then I said, I wondered to myself, how would he make that interesting to the guy who is the bombardier?
Yeah.
And does nothing.
Sat there and smoked for 90% of the time.
But instead of that, we each of us had one plane with a whole crew, and there are six of us at our table who had a squadron of six planes, and then there are three other tables also, each with their own squadron of planes. And so he had new rules for flying the planes in formation, or for getting attacked by fighters who are shooting at the whole squadron as they fly past. And then, you know, he had made it all up, and so it worked really well. Now, the whole game itself, while certainly very evocative and tells you the story, it's pretty much just a whole bunch of dice rolling and looking up results on charts.
Yes.
And some of which lead you to more charts, and those results lead you to other charts. And it does tell you the story, but by the end of the game, I was really wanting to computerize all the charts and just have it roll all the dice for me.
Right. You hit one button and it says, and you return, and you have 14 points.
That's right. You turned, you hit your target, and this guy died.
Right.
But the cool part that I thought was really neat was came at the beginning and at the middle of the mission. So since you were our designated person who went to the briefing, why don't you tell us about
that? Yes. All right. So first, before we even sat down to actually start the game, they had us color and decorate our B-17s. He had cutouts of an illustration of the B-17, so
yes,
we got to do our nose art on it.
I thought that was fun.
And my B-17 was the Calipagian, and it had appropriate nose art for that particular word. It was a lot of fun. And our squadron was Squadron Whiskey Tango Fabulous, I think, was the name we chose for our squadron. And I love it! Anyway, so I've got to give props. A game with make and do and coloring for the first 4 minutes of it is kind of fun. But then they started the mission briefing. So the leader of each squadron got to go to the briefing and be told where the target is, how far out it would be, where they want you to hit, what primary targets were, what secondary targets were, and you got to take a look at some recon photos on on an overhead projector for 30 seconds or 25 seconds or whatever it was. Now, our squadron leader, who had played before, none of us had played except for one guy at the table who'd played before, he wasn't able to go. He had to go by dinner or something like that. I don't know what it was. So they sent me over to go get the squadron briefing, although I'd never played before. And it was really interesting because they gave me all sorts of information. I'm trying to make notes as best as I can. And then they flashed this picture up for, you know, I'm just going to keep saying 15 seconds. Next time I say it, it's going to be 5 seconds. It'll get down to...
It seemed like not long enough.
It was never long enough.
But you were there with your clipboard and sketch pad and trying to sketch little notes of the map.
Right, because it was an aerial photo that could have come off of Google Earth or something like that. Probably not. But it was this aerial photo in grainy black and white.
Yeah.
And so you had to figure
out...
an
actual overhead projector.
So right, it was like an actual overhead projector. So it was really bad overhead projector quality. And you'd see it for a couple of seconds, and they'd say, this mark here is where we want you to hit. This is a primary target. This is a secondary target. This is whatever. Now go. And they'd flip it off. And I'd have to go back. And now I'm the one that has to survive.
That's right.
When we get to the actual target, I'm the only person that's seen the target and know exactly where it is.
We need to hit this square building that's next to a star-shaped building.
Right, hit the square building next to the star-shaped building near the fork in the road or whatever, and so I know where those are. And if I die, then I'm not allowed to pass on that information, and people just drop their bombs wherever. luckily, it never got to that. My guy was, you know, he never actually took any damage or no serious damage. And we were able to do that. But then when we arrived... So I'm not going to get to the arrived part. So as we were flying, we fly through different zones. The different zones have different concentrations of enemies and different kinds of enemies.
Right.
And different kinds of weather. And the weather patterns affect your roles and your charts and your enemies and blah, blah. Until you finally get over the area where you're supposed to drop the bombs. And then they roll for weather to find out what the cloud cover is.
Right.
And so they said, all right, it's 70% cloud cover. So then he comes around with a piece of paper that is 70% cloud covered, but has, you know, the other...
It's basically that same photo.
It's that same photo, but it's got cloud cover all over it. It's like 70% of cloud cover. And they put it down. They go, this is what you see. Where are you going to tell everyone to drop the bomb? And I have to go through and say, your battleship is at B-17. I've got to hit it B-17's a bad one. Like, you know, G-4. You know, I want to hit G-4 is where I want to go.
There was a grid overlaid on it. Right?
Right. So there was a grid. Gave everyone a grid position. And then everyone had to make rolls to see how well they could execute going along that particular grid for the bombing run. We rolled really well.
Yeah.
And I want to say that my spotting was excellent, and we all managed to hit the primary target in some very serious ways and did massive amounts of damage to it and hit it spot on and had no drift. So we did a really good job in actually doing it. And then
70% cloud cover sounded like it would be huge,
yeah,
but it turned out that you could still see
where the bend in the road was and where the star-shaped building was, and then you know you make an educated enough guess and you're
I know we all drift. Heard that 70%, we're like, oh my god, we're not gonna be able to see the target.
Right, it's gonna be 70% white, this thing. No, it was a little bit
still 70% was still pretty good.
Yeah. So, and then we were all elated with this. We're like, woo, we got the bomb. We're done. Woo. And they're like, done. You're halfway through. You have to make it back to base. And we're like, oh, we're halfway through the game. Now we get to roll dice for another 2 hours or 2.5 hours to get
back
to base.
Through
six more zones and land, and then see if we can manage to stick the landing. So it's a lot of fun.
And so we did do that. We got all the way through. And I think out of... I wrote down here 4 tables of 6, but I think we only had 3 tables. And out of, I think, 18 planes, I think we only lost 1 or 2, right?
I think we lost 2.
We lost two planes.
We lost 1 from our squad, and
our squadron commander.
Our squadron commander, yeah. The guy who had played before and who wasn't there for the briefing got shot down. And he'll be honored forever. We gave him a posthumous medal.
We'll remember him.
And one of the cool things about this game is if you want to continue to play with this guy, he runs this at cons all around California, And oh, yeah. he and will he keep track of you, and he keeps the stats on how many missions you've been on, and you get advancements, and you can eventually make it to be a squadron commander if you are sufficiently, if you have a sufficient rank after taking so many bombing missions.
Oh yeah, it looked like a lot of fun, and he really gets into it, and he was all in uniform and everything.
Yeah, so, he was in uniform, he had a pointer, and it was great.
And there's a picture up of the map that he had on the wall. That's showing all the different zones as we get from base out to the target in Germany. So, yeah, that was pretty cool. So, so that was B-17, Queen of the Skies.
Multiplayer, multi-plane, multi-squadron edition. Homebrew.
So the next day, we were there pretty late, went to sleep. And then the next day in the morning, we had some unscheduled time. And so we played a few games with our friends in the open gaming area. Now, Joey had just brought Red November, and we played that one. I really like this one. It's a fun, fast game. In this one, all the players are gnomes on a nuclear submarine.
How can this go wrong? Gnomes on a submarine.
That's right, on a nuclear submarine.
Yes.
Nuclear gnomes. I like to think that they spell nuclear with a G.
They do.
The submarine has only 1 hour to make it back to port because it's suffering a lot of problems, and there are lots of things going wrong on the sub. And you start out 1 hour out of port. The air pressure is dropping, the engines are breaking down, compartments are flooding, and the nuclear missiles are occasionally starting to count down.
Oh, man.
And so all the players have to rush around the ship, trying frantically to fix things as fast as they can while other problems are popping up. There's a really cool mechanic, I thought, where everything you try to do takes a certain amount of time, and the play order depends on who has spent the least amount of time, and each player can't accomplish more than 60 minutes worth of tasks before the game is over. I thought that was really neat, and you can try to get gnomish vodka, which helps you gain your courage so you can enter the rooms full of flame and things like that.
The radiation chambers or whatever.
So it's pretty fun. I will probably pick that one up. I think I have a picture or two of that one up.
Fun.
Later that day, I had a big game of Legends of the High Seas. This was another big six-hour miniatures extravaganza on another gigantic, big, nice terrain with great miniatures that the game runner had brought. This is mostly the same system as Legends of the Old West, except there are pirates instead of gunslingers.
Wait, I see a pattern in the game systems you're playing this year. There's Alamo, Legends of the Old West, now Legends of the High Seas.
Legends of the High Seas. Yes, I need more games about legends.
You're right. Throw a few of myths, some legends.
There's six players in this game. We had a really cool jungle terrain, and each of the six players had a squad of five pirates, which consisted of one captain, who was really cool, one mate, who was a little bit less cool, and a couple of thugs, who were cannon fodder.
Who were completely uncool.
That's right. And in addition, he had little treasure chests scattered around the map, and which, when you ran up to one and spent a turn opening it, you could contain treasure, which would give you more points, enemies, or animals, like a panther or a gorilla that maybe wants to fight you.
Like asps?
Asps, gems.
Yes.
Someone's been playing Tomb of Horrors.
Yes.
Or even there could be friendly pirates that would join your gang. And
In a chest? Friendly pirates?
I ran up to one, and it said, okay, you found two friendly pirates. And I was like, okay, I let them out of the chest.
That's right.
Everyone enjoyed that. And then you get points for killing enemy pirates, and then the winner was whoever had the most points at the end.
Yes.
And there are some cool pictures of that, and this is one of those games that really benefits from having nice terrain and nice miniatures and everything. I think one of the chests had natives. There was angry priests that were angry missionaries that were trying to convert the natives, but they didn't like pirates interfering, so they had to fight them to the death.
There you go.
But one of them had a big staff with a cross on it, so, you know, that's deadly.
Yes.
So after
that... He can bean you with that.
After that, we played another game in the open gaming area, which Joey had...
Wait. Actually, before you go on to this one, I want to tell you what we were doing were playing Legend of the High Seas.
What were you guys doing while I was at this
for
6 hours?
We were playing Temple of the Beastmen.
Oh, yes. Temple of the Beastmen. I want to hear about this. Unfortunately, I have no pictures of it, but tell me about
it. Yes, I have no pictures. Well, it is a really old game.
Yes.
By the makers of Space 1889, who's that? Game Designers, GDW, was it? I don't remember who it was.
I think that's right.
And it is a tile map game, a discovery. So you lay out these maps with these tiles that are unknown, and you have some characters that go through, and they are traveling through the Temple of the Beastmen, discovering things as they go, they each have some victory conditions. If you're one character, you're supposed to save a person. Another one, you're supposed to retrieve an artifact. And you're racing each other through the Temple of the Beastmen, trying to defeat Beastmen guards that are trying to kill you, and looting it and ransacking it or whatever in order to get whatever it is you need.
And to be clear, in the Space 1889 universe, this is on Mars. This is taking place, and these are Martian Beastmen.
Right? Right. So this is all on Mars. The Beastmen are Martians,
right.
And the non-Beastmen are Victorian steampunk adventurers.
Right.
And so there's that whole Great White Hunter motif going through there. It's colonialism writ large. You know, running through there, just killing whatever natives happen to be in there so you can get the jewels or so you can rescue a particular valuable slave or something like that and get
right.
out of there. It was a lot of fun. It was nice and simple. It was fast moving. The pieces, I thought, needed to be redone a little bit, and I've got plans to work with Mark to try to see if we can get some of those redone so we can make it into a high-class, high-production value game.
You going to run that next year?
Sure. If we can do it, if we can extrude it into the third dimension, like I'm sort of hoping, it'll be kind of fun to run. Because it was easy to learn and fast to play, and that's great for a con if you're going to run a game.
Oh,
because
yeah.
you want people to wander by and say, hey, this looks cool, I want to play. And then you can teach them in 5 minutes or less and have a couple of games that way. So anyway, Temple of the Beastmen, it's a lot of fun.
Cool.
We had a good time with it, and then you were done and you came back.
I don't know what that you probably did more stuff during
that
time.
We probably did, and that's the only one I remember off the top. It was early, and I had not had too many energy drinks by then.
I
only had my first.
There's always the vendor room, too.
Yeah.
So anyway, after that, I met up with you guys, and we played another game that Joey had either bought or brought, I don't remember, and that is Mall of Horror.
Mall of Horror!
And this is a paranoia slash negotiation game in which all the players have a group of people that are trapped in various parts of a mall which is being besieged by zombies.
Yes.
Everyone loves zombies, and they love malls.
On crackers.
Let's put them together.
What? Oh, wait. How'd that go?
Zombies on crackers.
Well, I don't know. I don't... I don't know where that went, and I don't know why.
Anyway, every round of the game, you have to run from store to store in the mall, and you get to vote against who of the other survivors you want to throw out to the zombies to try to save yourself.
Yes.
And every player has this little voting wheel that you use to make secret votes, and you vote for or against each of the other factions.
Right.
And so each player is a faction which has a few different people, and you have a tough guy, you have a crazy guy with a gun, you have a screaming girl.
Screaming girl. Screaming girls attract zombies. Tough guys are good at, at fighting off zombies if you're going to do that. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. And I would have to play it a few more times, but I thought it was neat the way the zombies build up, and you're slowly whittling people down one by one.
Right. Now, it is really, like you said, it was a paranoia and negotiation game. You all want to really stay alive yourself so you can win and get points, but
yes.
You need other people. But you need other people for two reasons. You need other people for strength to fight the zombies, and you need them as distractions and food for the zombies so you can get away.
Yes, it's kind of like a Survivor or something like that, where you have to make temporary alliances with people while everyone is doing these alliances while knowing that they are eventually going to betray the other people.
Right,
in their
or they're actively trying to betray them that round in order to
That's
get their
right.
way, and it's kind of fun that way.
Because you all want to be alive, but you all need each other, at least in the short term.
Yes, yes. So Mall of Horrors was negotiation plus backstabbing plus zombies equals a rollicking good time. We played that together, plus a couple of other guys that wandered by and saw the game and said, hey, what's that game? And we said, hey, it's Mall of Horror. And they said, well, can we play? And we said, sure. And they sat down. So I wish I remembered their names. I was going to write it down so I could shout out.
I like it when you do all the voices.
I did all. One of them was Irish and said, hey, can I play? No. Boy, that was bad. But I don't do impressions except that one and poorly.
Suddenly I'm hungry for Lucky Charms.
Oh, you should. So we had our regular complement of people that were there, plus we were there in open gaming. And open gaming, Kubla Khan, is walk around, see a game you like, ask if you can be in it, and find some really fun games to play in. And so we got to meet up with some really nice guys that played Mall of Horror with us and also played the next game
with us.
Yes,
and the next game was a game that you had brought, Nate.
No.
Yes.
No.
You didn't bring this?
I did not bring this.
Oh, okay.
Mark brought this.
Oh, Mark brought it.
But it is one that I own, and it's one I've been threatening to play for a long time, which is why you thought it was me.
That's why I thought it was yours, because you've had it and wanted to play it for so long.
Yes.
So this is a cheap-ass game, and it's called Captain Park's Imaginary Polar Expedition. So tell us about this game.
Okay, well, first of all...
And by us, I mean me.
That's right. Well, first of all, it's a cheap-ass game. So if you're not familiar with James Ernest's cheap-ass games, they are game rules and the bare basic game pieces you need to play, but not counting all of the normal game pawns and dice and counters and other things you might need for a game. So they have, you know, the cards, the board pieces, the rules, and you furnish the rest. And because of that,
And the board pieces are typically printed on, like, cardstock or something.
Right. They're on cardstock. So you end up paying $7 for either a really great game or a mediocre game, but it's $7. Hey, it's much cheaper than a $60 Fantasy Flight game, and you can buy a bunch
of
them.
That's right.
I'm a big fan of the cheap-ass games. I have a giant... I want to say giant tub full of them. I have an extensive collection of cheap-ass games, and I really like... I think they can't all be gems, but I'll say that a good 75% of them are gems, and another 10% are good but not gems, and all the rest I probably will never play again because they weren't that good.
But for the price you're paying, you know, there's a bit of a lower bar.
Oh, yeah, I totally get $4 to $7 worth of enjoyment out of every one of these games, and that's
right.
Why they're called cheap-ass games. They're nice and cheap, and they're worth picking up.
So what is this game? What's the premise of this? Sea Pipe?
So let me tell you, Sea Pipe. Yes, Captain Park's Imaginary Polar Expedition, Sea Pipe. Wow, it's almost like a programming term. Okay, so here it is. It's a scavenger hunt game, essentially. The chrome is that Captain Park is a famous explorer who became a famous explorer by not actually going anywhere, but by going and buying weird stuff and taking it back to the gentleman's club, bragging about it and telling people where he got it from, or lying about where he got it from, okay? So we have all discovered that this is how he got his position in the gentleman's club and how he got his own chair named after him or whatever. So we are all interested in doing the same thing, in going around London, staying out of sight from other members of the Adventurers Club, finding interesting and cool things, and then showing up 4 to 6 months later saying, I've just been to Mount Everest, and doing that.
And look, I got this shrunken head.
And look, I got a shrunken head, and the people were amazing. Essentially, the game runs like pawns moving around a board, so it's a free-form movement around the board, and every station in the board, you have a chance to either pick up something. You know, you play a card out of your hand to pick it up, but you have to be in that particular spot to play it and put it in front of you. And these are things you're collecting. You end up going to a book store to get an ancient tome. You end up going to a knick-knack store to get a monkey's paw or whatever, you know, as you go around. And all the time there is a Captain Park pawn moving around the board who could catch you. Could land on the same spot you are, or get moved off there by somebody else's card or something else that they're doing. And if he catches you, then the jig is up and you don't get to say you've been on safari, because he knows that he just saw you down at the West End, you know, drinking coffee, and so you can't say you were in Everest, and you've got to start your timer all over.
Yeah.
And you've got to stay away for a certain number of months, and then you come back with your stuff. So you travel around the board, avoid Captain Park, gather your stuff, get enough of it together that you can make it back to the Adventurers Club.
And you're trying to avoid the other players too, aren't you?
I think the other players, I don't remember exactly, but I don't remember trying to avoid them.
Okay.
So for the most part, you're avoiding Captain Park.
Right.
Well, you kind of want to avoid the other players because the other players can help move Captain Park. It's sort of like a Kill Dr. Lucky sort of mechanic where Captain Park is not a regular mover. He can be disrupted by other players, and so you don't want to be right next to him because they may make him skip over or jump through or whatever, if I remember correctly. So it's go around, collect, make it back to the gentleman's club, cash in, and then go out on another adventure. And once you hit the certain number of points, you win. This was a lot of fun because of the hilarity of the combinations. It's like, I went to Mount Everest and I got a monkey's paw. I already said monkey's paw. I got a monkey's paw and an ancient tome and stories about men with bowls on their heads that are full of water that they can't spill or whatever, and you look at that, and some of them are crazy, and they're sort of fun to put together in a Mad Libs sort of way. Yeah, so yeah. It's the Great White Hunter meets Mad Libs.
Oh yeah, that's kind of
sort
funny.
Of thing going on. So yeah, Captain Park's Imaginary Polar Expedition was my favorite cheap ass game of this entire con.
The top one out of
the
one.
The top one. Now it says, and I just looked it up here on Board Game Geek, and it says best with five players. I think
we had five,
and it was a great game. It was a great game of five. I've never played it with any other number, but I will tell you that Board Game Geek says best five, best with five. I agree.
There we go.
Best with five.
That was indeed our best experience with that particular game.
That's right.
so that was that game. So after this, we all had dinner, and then we met in the upper lounge area for a game of Federation Commander. And I think we have talked about this on the podcast.
We have, and if we haven't, we are going to again, because we promised we would do a series on Star Trek tactical games,
yes.
And I'm not sure how many we've gotten through or how many we have left.
That's still on the table.
Okay.
But so I know Joey had been really itching to play this game. And we had a good game with you, Joey, Mark, and my brother Aaron as four players, and I was the one sort of teaching and running the game and keeping things moving. So, Nate, you and Joey were the Federation. We had the classic Federation versus Klingons matchup here.
Of course.
Joey had a heavy cruiser, which is basically what the Enterprise is in the old show, and you had two smaller Federation frigates.
Yep.
And then on the other side, Mark had a Klingon D7, which is pretty much the match for the Federation heavy cruiser, and then Aaron had two small Klingon frigates. And so both sides had a large ship and two small ships. Went a bit slow at first, as everyone sort of learned the rules, but then it sped up. And even though this game went for a really long time, longer than I expected, I think they all liked it. So what do you think?
All right. Well, I think you're right. And I think there was a bell curve of excitement and fun with the game. At the very beginning, it was kind of slow as everyone was going through and looking at, so how do I move? How do I, fire? How does this work? Trying to distribute their energy. And doing all the things that you need to do in Federation Commander.
Right.
It's a steep learning curve. And so that first section goes incredibly slowly. We had people coming by 2 hours later, and we're like, we're on turn number two. And they're like, oh my gosh, how are you going to play this game?
And it did get faster once everyone figured
exactly.
it out.
That's as soon as people went through a couple turns, they caught on, they're ready to go, they could plan faster, play faster, and then we move into excitement, and people are moving, and people are firing, and it gets really exciting until at a certain point, it's obvious who's winning. And at that point, it becomes a tedious mopping up thing where the people that are obviously winning are so outclassing the ones that are obviously losing in some way or another.
Like, they're going to kill them eventually. It's just going to be a sort of a tedious slog.
It's just how long. Yes. It's just, then it becomes the long slog. And as I was playing, and as soon as we hit that long slog part at the end, I thought, maybe we should just call the game now. But I thought, but they want the victory. They want total victory. Anyway,
The Federation lost this one, right?
Yes, we lost. I would like to say, for the record, we love you, Joey. But Joey didn't listen to me, and so we lost as the Federation.
Well, he was the flagship. He shouldn't have been listening to those smaller ships.
Well, but he should have listened to the player who'd played it a dozen times. So it just so happens that the two little frigates had admirals running, and people that had been in lots of battles knew...
But these were admirals who had pissed off the upper admirals, and they busted them down to captain.
That's right. They were mavericks. They were always out there following their own rules, but getting results. And
they said, "No, we're busting you back down to captain."
They did.
They're taking on a frigate.
That's right. And then they put Federation heavy cruiser.
We're putting you under the 22-year-old captain of the...
That's right. The freshly minted captain. No, Joe, you did a great job. But... best of luck to you. It was good. No, he was good. We all had a good time playing, and he caused some major damage and carnage and everything.
Did you lose both of the frigates or one of them?
I don't remember how that ended. Actually, I think I lost one of them. I lost one of them running interference, trying to save the heavy frigate long enough for him to get off another fire.
Okay.
I think so. I ran some interference trying to soak up some damage, and so I sacrificed one of them. And I had another one that was untouched,
fairly
well. So it could have gone a little better on the Federation side, but you win some, you lose some, and that sounded really trite and horrible, but it's true. And we had just as much fun losing as we do winning. No, that's a lie. Maybe a little bit less, but we had a lot of fun playing.
Well, yeah, so it was good to run it for some new players and teach it to some people who had never played it before. And so as I was going through this and running the game and trying to keep things moving, I ended up coming with some good ideas for play aids for the game that I think I want to make the next time I get a bunch of people together. There's a few things that you have to do secretly and simultaneously in this game, and you have to do them a lot. And one of those is to choose your speed for the turn, or choose whether or not you're going to accelerate in each impulse. So, for example, each of the ships can go at a speed of either 0, 8, 16, or 24, and everyone chooses that secretly and then reveals it simultaneously. And you do that every turn. So what we did in the game is we used six-sided dice, and we used a 1, 2, or 3 to represent 8, 16, or 24, and then a 6 to indicate speed 0. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking of getting some
blank six-sided dice
and marking those up and handing those out as actual play aids.
I think that would have worked a lot. I mean, it's one of those things that you either have to keep track of or post in a public space, but is just easier to be kept as a counter in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you want to know what speed the other ships are without having to ask, oh, how fast are you going again?
Well, and it helped you in running the game to be able to do the movement order, because the movement order is in order of speed.
Exactly.
And so as you're determining who's going to move at whatever sub-impulse and when, you could just glance around the table and say,
he's got a 2, he's got a 1, yeah, exactly.
Right, right.
That made it really... So I definitely want to use that next time I play a game with more than, you know, two ships, need to do that. Another thing that I was thinking about doing, in each game, each ship can do a single, what they call, high-energy turn. And each ship can do that one time per game. It's something where you basically get to reset your facing to whatever you want. But you can only do that one time. Or actually, I should say, you can do it multiple times, but at the second and further times, you have a very, very high chance of doing severe damage to your ship.
Right. The chance of blowing up on the second one and later is pretty high.
So you get one free one. And you want to make sure you use it, because it is a resource that if you don't use it, it's a waste, and you do want to use it. So I thought it would be nice to have some tokens to pass out, one per ship, to indicate whether you've used your high-energy turn yet. You know, having that token in front of them would remind beginning players that it's something they do want to take advantage of. And use it before your ship gets destroyed, or else, it's just a waste.
Right. And so this play-aid mechanic we've also used in a number of other games to keep track of one-time use powers.
Yeah, I used that also for Battlestar Galactica.
Right, right.
Player has a one-time use power, and I handed out poker chips to everyone to say, here, this is your one-time use power, and this having this in front of you reminds you, hey, I need to use this before you
are a Cylon or you die or whatever.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a nice mechanic, and it reminds the player that they've got something that they can use, and it keeps you from saying, did I do that last turn? Yeah. I meant to. Did I not end up
and
doing that?
And it lets everyone else know also if you used it or not.
Exactly.
Which is all public knowledge, and they could keep track of it, but hey, it makes it easier for everyone.
Right.
So by this time, we finished our game. It was pretty late, and we were all very tired. Aaron left to go home, but the rest of us were there, the other four of us, and in that sleepy state, it was a perfect time for another game that Nate had also been dying to play, which is Hero Card Nightmare.
Right. Here we were in the middle of the night in a dark convention, and I pulled out Hero Card Nightmare, the Hero Card game I bought the year before at the convention the year before.
I remember that.
And didn't ever actually play until this moment, and so we pulled it out. It, like other hero games, has the card mechanic of three different pools, and you play cards against the pools in order to do attacks or defense.
But what's the premise of this game that's really cool?
Yes, thank you. The premise...
Sorry, I don't mean to push you along. Like,
come on, it's good. It's all good. And people are thinking that too. Come on, we already talked about Hero Card. I understand. Okay, so the premise, the chrome on the game, which I really liked, is you are a bunch of lucid dreamers, but you're co-lucid dreamers. You're all sharing the same dream. So all the characters are sharing the same dreamscape, the same place, and they're all being chased by killers through the dreamscape. So there's the
various
hitchhiker,
monsters.
There's the zombie, there's the monster from the Black Lagoon. There are a bunch of monsters. And so you as character, or you as players, what you try to do is you try to match up locations in the dreamscape with killer monsters in the dream and say, I am sending this monster to this location and having them kill your player, or you in the dream, and then you do your battle of whether or not it's going to actually succeed. But instead of killing, what it is, it's actually not killing. You say, "I want to scare your I want to scare your player." And what you have to do if you lose, you have to reveal if you were scared or not. And that scare mechanic is part of the deduction element of the game. So now this moves out of the Chrome into the actual game itself. What you're supposed to figure out is figure out which monster and which place scares which character. And so they all know at the beginning of the game, they draw and they know what thing is going to kill them
everyone
or what
gets,
thing can kill them.
Everyone gets a monster card and a location card and you keep that face down.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and so you keep those and so you know what combination will take you out of the game, and in the game Chrome, it's you've had a dream and you know how you're going to die and that's how you're going to die. And
you know I'm going to die when the zombie came after me at the cabin.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so you know that when the zombie in the cabin and it attacks finally, then you're done. And so that's exactly what you end up doing, is you move around, you can move around the dreamscape, you can move around the monsters because you're one of the lucid dreamers, you help control what's going on, and everyone else is trying to control it, and you're trying to put things in front of people and say, does that scare you? And then when you figure out if they're scared or not of any particular thing, you do the deduction element of the game and find out that, oh yes, indeed Adam is scared of the zombie at the cabin after you've gone through and decided who's not scared of the cabin, who's not scared of the zombie, blah, blah, blah.
So you're doing these scare attacks where you say, okay, you put the zombie and the cabin together, and then you do this attack, and if you succeed at the attack, because everyone else could be defending, then everyone says, yes, I was scared, or no, I wasn't scared. Then you go and put the zombie at the forest and do another attack. And then you see who also said they were scared. And if they said that, then it means they might be scared of the zombie. That might be their thing.
Right.
Because they said
it can't
yes
be two places, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
and
that's
so you do this
sort
of deduction by moving the monsters and the locations around. And the other kind of neat thing is that the map is a shifting dreamscape.
Yes.
And so it's all these locations, but the locations move. And so what is, where the cabin is next to the forest one turn, well, it may not be next to it the next turn.
Right. Or you may not be able to get to the cabin from the forest because the different play tiles only allow movement through the dreamscape in different directions. So people are sometimes trying. So everyone is trying to keep their place and their monster as far from each other as possible.
Right.
Yet at the same time, putting the two together that they think will scare somebody else to death.
Right.
And everyone can defend against any given scare attack, because this attack happens, in the dreamscape, so everyone's affected. And so you may want to block it because you don't want to reveal that you are scared of one of those two things, or you may want to block it just to be a jerk to the other person and so that they don't learn anything. Or to do a misdirection to make people think that you're scared of something. I like to think of it as I was playing and I was thinking, wow, this is a way more interesting version of Clue.
Kind of is. Except it's a Clue where everyone is the killer and so you're trying to figure out everyone's secret combination.
Right. So everyone is the killer, everyone has a secret combination, and you're also a killer and you're trying to get them killed. You're trying to do that. So it's kind of fun, and it's a great little it's a great little game. And I bought it, honestly, I bought it solely for the story, the Chrome behind it. The you're all lucid dreamers sharing a dream, trying to kill the other sleepers.
I know you.
And
you
I
were,
thought, oh, that's awesome. I'm buying that. I don't care how it plays.
You were a big fan of Nightmare on Elm Street, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I saw it in my formative years. Let's put it that way.
I saw it
in my formative years.
And this is certainly evocative of that sort of thing, where you can die in your dream when you're scared to death.
Yes.
So, yeah, and it has the hero card battling mechanic, which we already think is kind of cool.
And because we were playing at, 3 o'clock in the morning, we had a really hard time keeping straight who was scared of what. And so I think the game went a little longer and slower than we normally would have done it, or it normally would play, because we were like, wait, who was scared the last time?
That's right.
I don't remember.
Hard
who
to
would
keep
it?
Those logical deductions in mind.
Yeah, and no one was taking notes, so it was like, oh, it was great. Yeah.
So that was kind of fun. I would like to play that again, but again, it's one of the games that really would not be good with two. I don't even think you can play it with two.
No, you can't. It's like a three.
You have
or,
to do at least three, and better to have even up to five, I think.
Right. Yeah, something like that.
So, yeah, so Hero Card Nightmare, check it out. So that was the last game of that night, and then everyone went to bed and presumably did not die in their dream.
No, but I did manage to kill four or five other congoers in a dream by finding out what their fears were.
That's why it was
enough,
less crowded
some
the next
of them
day.
Were girls. No. So I,
I was scared of the girl at the con.
The girl in the parents' basement, and I died.
That would
Sorry.
Be terrible. That would be a bad way to go. So let's see. So
I don't know.
The next day of the con was the last day, Monday, which is a half day for the convention. Usually not much goes on that day.
Right.
We didn't have anything scheduled at all, so we all decided to play Arkham Horror, the base game of Arkham Horror. I think Mark bought it that time, right?
No, that was Joey.
That was Joey's?
Oh, wait. No, that wasn't Joey. I don't remember.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Well,
I'm just going to say it doesn't matter, yeah.
But so we had the base game of Arkham Horror, and we played that. Now, I had played this once before a long time ago, only the base game. I understand that there has been about a zillion expansions since then.
Right.
Joey is an expert at this. He loves this game, and he has played it with all the expansions. So he ran it and sort of set it up and got us going.
And all at the same time, all the expansions. So he's,
yeah.
he was amazed at the simplicity of the game by setting it up in the base version.
And it is fairly complex if you've never played it before, but he's like, oh my gosh, it's so clean. It's just the vanilla Arkham Horror. So clean and fast. So I like this game, although I'm probably not a big enough fan of the whole Lovecraft mythos to get a lot out of it. My favorite mechanic is the sliding ability scales, where you can choose to maximize certain attributes of your character at the cost of minimizing others. I don't want to go into this game too much, because I think we've talked about it before. What did you think about this? I know this is one of the games you really wanted to play at this con.
Yeah, I've actually wanted to play Arkham Horror for years. I wanted to play it last year at the con, and it conflicted with something, and this year I was really happy to be able to get in a game. My favorite part about Arkham Horror is, honestly, I like the setting. I am a Lovecraft mythos fan. I've read the August Derleth books. Now I've screwed up his name, so now people say I'm not really a fan. Well, and you may be right. I read the books. I've read all the Lovecraft stuff. I went through a Lovecraft phase where I was just reading everything that was possible. Back in the early internet days before the web, I used to frequent an FTP site that frequently uploaded new popular references to the Lovecraft mythos. And it would say, you can find a reference to Nyarlathotep in this, in this book. And I would go back and then I'd take the list to the library and go look up the stuff.
Wow, you were a big fan.
I was. I really was. I read lots of it. I loved it. The game itself is a fun game, and it is complicated enough that there's a lot of stuff to keep track of. It is sort of deadly enough that it never seems like a walk in the park. You're always barely on the edge of sanity trying to fight the hordes coming in.
And you have both your hit points and your sanity points to keep track of.
there is no Lovecraft game without additional sanity points in addition to hit points. And so as a constructed game, as for gameplay, it was challenging and interesting and complex. And on top of that, we overlaid a chrome or a mythos that I really like. And so to me, it was a complete winner of a game. I will never have enough people together in the same room to play it again, except at the con. Not going to be able to get my my younger kids to play with me because they'll be like, even though I did buy them Cthulhu stuffed animals a couple years ago from the con, came home with my, Nyarlathotep and ancient Yuggoths and all those things. They were not fans. So I'm never going to be able to get all these things together at the same time. So I look forward to next year when I horn in on another game and get a chance to play.
Well, I hope you can play. It's kind of complex. And Joey, of course, has played this a zillion times. He knew exactly what to do. And so he was kind of running all of us in this game by sort of saying, whenever things come up, okay, you need to go here and you need to fight this and then you need to do that. And he knew exactly what to do. So,
I wouldn't say, I mean, he did some of that, but he did a lot of, he did a lot of telling us what's important. It's important to close these things as soon as possible.
True.
It's important to fight these things, and it's important to stay out of the streets when these things are in the air.
That's true.
And so by that sort of guidance, with us not knowing anything about the game, that was a leg up enough to avoid a bunch of rookie mistakes.
That's true.
So I think he did do his fair share of telling us what to do, but it was welcome because we didn't know what to
yes,
do. But on top
indeed.
Of that, it was the general overall advice on what are good places you know, if you want to accomplish X, do Y. Advice went a long way with us, and I think we all internalized it and ran with it pretty well.
Oh yeah, sure. I would agree with that. So Arkham Horror, I think we will have to play that again next year at the con.
Right. I would threaten to buy it, except like I said, I'm never going to be able to get like 5-6 people together to play it anytime soon. So.
And Joey plays it solo. You can play by yourself.
Yeah, that seems to me creepy and wrong. But sorry, Joey. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's fun. Yeah. I'll take his word for it that it's fun that way.
So anyway, that was the last game on Monday, and that was about it. So we had a great time at the convention.
Yes, we did.
Hanging out with our old high school gaming buddies, going through the vendor area. I think I bought way too many dice this year, like I always do.
Yes.
And
we ran into friend of the podcast, Bay, there.
Yes, we did run into Bay there. I got to chat with him, so shout out to Bay. Good to see you there. And, we can't wait to go again next year. Yep. Maybe I'll we'll make it out to some of the other Bay Area cons this year. Who knows? But anyway.
I know. I'm not going. But I am going to KublaCon next year.
We will see everyone at KublaCon next year.
Yes.
That's the show, and we are out of here. We'll be back. We'll be back when we're back. When will that be? Only the Shadow knows.
And he ain't talking. If you do want to contact us in the meantime, you can send email to roll2d6@gmail.com, or you can post a comment on the roll2d6.com website. If you like the show, tell a friend about it, or post a review on your favorite podcast review site, or start a mutual fund with the ticker symbol Roll2D6.
Oh, yeah, I just checked that symbol, not yet taken. So move fast. Anyway, see you next time, everyone.
See ya.